Okay. So the project one is due on 20th, which is what? Next Tuesday. So basically the next class. So apparently very few questions. The assumption would be that it's easy enough that you're getting done. Okay. I will release project two, which basically involves extending project one, I mean project part one, with PageRank and authorities and hubs, essentially almost next week, because we will actually be discussing that stuff starting today, and by the end of next class, we'd have known the PageRank and authorities hubs, which you would be using for that. Okay. So are there any questions before we go and continue? So the main, the concluding insight last class was, while it is true that small world phenomena exist in random graphs, there is a question as to whether real world graphs are random graphs. Okay. If you remember, the small world phenomena will exist in random graphs if the effective degree is more than one. Once the effective degree is more than one, then the diameter shrinks and you would have a short path between any pair of nodes. Diameter is essentially the largest distance between any two nodes in the graph. So that was good enough. That sort of removes some of the, so why does that remove the paradox of, the seeming paradox of small world phenomena? I mean, why does the fact that you have random graphs with degree greater than one will have short diameters, why does that explain small world phenomena for random networks, random social networks? Because what was the reason? The reason is? So what's the main point from the social network's point of view? Why is it the case? Why is it the case that you have a sharp peak, I mean the phase transition at 1.0 effective degree, why does that help us realize that it's no surprise that there is small world phenomena if in fact the networks are random?
Because in the real world, people are connected to more than one person.
That's
so
the point.
Degree is always much greater than
one. So because the effective degree is always greater than one, and because this is a sharp threshold, that means even a little more than one, you would get into small world. It's clear that you should not be surprised if the world is made up of random networks. Okay. However, we pointed out last time that, in fact, the world is not made up of random networks, where random, by random I mean uniform random networks. It's made up of other type of random networks. It's biased random networks. Okay. So essentially any other distribution of the degree, any other distribution of, any other distribution of connections between nodes other than the uniform distribution that we have used would lead to random networks, except those are not uniform random. Okay. Of all the many possible such distributions, we notice that an important class, so in general you have this most real world networks, if you plot their degree distribution, so if you plot the degree distribution of a random network, a uniform random network, the degree distribution would be a Poisson distribution, which is sort of like exponential decay. Okay. Whereas in real world, I mean, in the kind of networks that you see, and you can analyze any type of networks for which you have data, you tend to see more the power law distribution. Okay, and what's interesting about the power law, of course, is rare events are not so rare. Okay, in normal distribution, whatever you might think of it, the interesting part about normal distribution is rare events are rare. That's why you want to talk about Six Sigma kids. But in power law distribution, rare events are not as rare as you are used to. Because if you don't think otherwise, most of the time you think in terms of normal distribution, where rare events are quite rare. Okay. And then we talked about how these distributions come about. Essentially, the analytical form for this essentially is some k power minus r, where r is the exponent with which the distribution is falling. Okay. And for most real networks, r is somewhere between 2 and 3, but any value of r, you know, would be called a power law. Any value of r greater than or equal to 1 would be called a power law. Now, this is the slide that I didn't show last time. Let me just talk about it a little. There are a couple of things. One point about power law distribution is it's also called scale-free distribution, and we'll keep talking about power law networks and scale-free networks. The reason it's called scale-free is the following formal property. If you consider the area under this curve from A to infinity, okay, and divided by the area under the, the area under this curve from B to infinity divided by that under the curve from A to infinity. Okay, and if you're considering how much probability mass is there from here on to infinity versus from here on to infinity. And if you compute that, it's very easy to do. It's essentially an integral or a sum of the distribution from here to infinity and from here to infinity. And you can show easily enough that would be b by a power 1 minus r. Okay, and what's interesting here is that the relative amount of probability mass seems to depend only on the ratio of a and b, not on the absolute values of a and b. So what that means is if a was here and B was here, it would still be B by A. And whether it is A was here and B was here, it will still be B by A. So another way of thinking about it is, these you can think of in terms of the degree distributions, right? So the relative area between nodes having popularity, the degree. So if you think in terms of these, in terms of, let's say, popularity, okay? The relative area in underneath that curve from popularity 10 to 100, 10 to infinity versus 100 to infinity is the same as that between 1000 to infinity and 10,000 to infinity. That's basically what we are saying. So if you look at just this part and zoom in on this, it looks like this again. Essentially, okay. So it's sort of it's been called self-similar and scale-free networks for that scale-free distribution for that reason. Okay. And another interesting point about these kinds of net distributions, if you think of them as probability distributions, is that a mean is a first-order movement. It's called a first-order movement, and a variance is a second-order movement, and so on. And an mth order movement exists only if r is greater than m plus 1. Okay, so in particular, if r equal to 1, then this is an harmonic series. If it's a harmonic series, what's the area under that curve? What's the sum of a harmonic series? Infinity. So you don't expect it to even have a mean. Normally, the reason why you can actually have harmonic series and still get by is because you never actually consider, it's artificially cut off at some point. Otherwise, if you think of it as a distribution going to infinity, then it does not actually have well-defined mean if x equal to 1. If x is greater than, if r equal to 1, if r is greater than 1, then that sum is defined. And in particular, in fact, it's defined as the Riemann zeta function. Well, all you care about is something that you know already, which is that the sequence 1 over n power r, you know, the series 1 over n power r does converge if r is greater than 1. Equal to 1, it doesn't. Okay? So those are just from the point of view of the, you know, viewing this as probability distribution. We noticed also last time that the power laws exist in many natural phenomena, including, can you see this? So there are two things here. One is, of course, power law. When you draw this on a log-log plot, it will be a straight line with the slope being equal to r. Okay, so this is one way you actually can check if some phenomena that you're observing follows power law. You know, you can try to plot it as a on a log-log plot, and if you know, and fit a straight line to it. The closest straight line gives you what is the approximate distribution, power law distribution, it's going. And here actually are bunches of examples where you see power law distribution. One other thing, in fact, what's interesting is the power laws actually came up much earlier from, these are also called Pareto distributions, and these are also called Zipf distributions for the reasons I discussed last class, but I'll mention again. The first time somebody mentioned this is Pareto, Alfred Pareto, I believe, Valfredo Pareto. How many of you know Pareto optimal sets? If you may have heard of Pareto in other contexts too, but this guy essentially pointed out that the distribution of wealth follows a power law. Okay, they may be super rich people, but irrespective of what you consider as your, okay, let's see the number of people having, you know, the income less than $1,000 a year, which looks like, you know, there should be very few people. But even there are stratifications. There are people with $1,000 a year, there are people with $900 a year, and so on. And the curve never dies down. Okay? So that was one of the places where he first actually found this, and, you know, people have found this in many other phenomena too. What happened now? Okay. And one other thing, since we talked about, so we got into power loss because we found that random networks do not account for the degree distribution that is observed in real world networks. Okay. Now remember that when you are generating the uniform random network, there is a generative model. The way you generated the uniform random network was, you had n nodes, you take any pair, and you have some probability parameter p, you toss a coin with probability parameter p, if it comes heads, you put an edge, otherwise you won't put an edge. That's all you do. This is the generative model. If you follow this generative model, then the degree distribution that you observe on the emergent network would be a Poisson distribution. So consequently, if you actually see a network whose distribution of degrees doesn't look like a Poisson distribution, then it could not have been generated by a uniform random selection process. And it's not surprising for us. In fact, let me cross over this and go to that discussion. I'll come back to this in a minute. So the idea is, what would be the generative process that would explain why you would see power law distribution of degree? Okay, can you tell me something I can do at node level, at individual node level, such that if I keep repeatedly doing that, you know, so individual nodes, you know, look at each other node, toss a coin, and decide whether to have a connection or not. If they follow that process, that would be the way you will get the Poisson distribution for the degree distribution. What would you have to do to get power law distribution? We know that power law distribution occurs, right? So what must be happening at the micro level so that at the macro level, power law distribution would be there? That would be quite interesting to understand. Okay, now the, you know, this is not the first time you ask this kind of question. So for example, you must have asked yourself, why is it that the normal distribution is universally used everywhere? Why is it reasonable to think of normal distribution for modeling everything? Most of the things, not everything. Did you guys ask yourself that? How many of you know the answer as to why normal distribution winds up being useful everywhere? So the reason why normal distribution winds up being observed in most emergent phenomena is because there is this rule, there is this theorem called central limit theorem, which says that if you have a quantity which you are observing, that's a linear expression on many, many, many other quantities, which each of which have any arbitrary distribution. Some can have uniform distribution, some can have Poisson distribution, it doesn't matter what they are having. But if the quantity you are observing is the sum of linear, basically a linear expression on the underlying distribution, that can be any possible distribution, then the sum's distribution would tend towards the bell curve. That's the reason why normal distribution is interesting. If you don't know this, then you're in trouble. I mean, in some sense, you should be wondering, why is it that everybody uses normal distribution for everything? And this is the reason. So there is a generative model for normal distribution that we can understand. You know, it's a reasonable explanation. Okay. Now the question is, what's the generative model for, in this particular case, power law distribution? And the generative models for power law distributions, there is no necessary and sufficient conditions, but there is a sufficient condition. Okay, multiple sufficient conditions. One sufficient condition is this: as the number of nodes grow, edges are added in proportion to the number of edges a node already has. If you do this, and this is not, what this is saying is, when you go into the junior high classroom as a new student, you start talking to people who are already popular. That's all this is saying. So if you are considering, if you're considering two nodes and one which already has a huge number of links to it, and two which has just one link to it, right? And you are N3, you just came in, you're the new kid on the block. The random distribution, uniform random distribution says with probability P you will have a link to this, with the same probability P you have a link to this. That's not true really. If you make the probability of link, probability that you have a link to a node be proportional to its current in degree already, which means popular nodes get more popular. This explains, this is one way of, if you do this, then the resulting network will have power law distribution. Okay, if you do this, the resulting network will have power law distribution. So this is sort of an explanation of, for example, why web level at the link structure of the web does have power law distribution. Because what this is saying is people tend to link to pages that are already popular. Okay, for a whole bunch of time, people used to link, for whatever reason, to Google, as if it needed one more link to it. Okay, but that's the way. You also know, for example, that if you break into the most popular articles on any news site, they just become more popular, because most people who come to that particular site are likely to first look at what are people thinking are the most popular networks. So popularity does tend to breed on itself to some extent. Okay, so this is not something that we are surprised at. But it's interesting to note that if you do that, then you will have power law distribution of the degree. There was a question, yes.
Is this somewhat analogous to simulated annealing, in that in simulated annealing, you change the probability based on the time.
Mm-hmm.
You change the probability based on the in degree or the popularity.
No, all you are saying is you are biasing the probability. That's the only thing that's common between them. Yeah, you're only that's the only commonality. There is no real deep issue. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you explain why this small world phenomena exists with random graphs, but you're saying the real world is not random
Yeah.
So with this experiment,
that's what we'll be talking about in a minute. It turns out, so we sort of started by saying that random worlds will have small world phenomena, random graphs will have small world phenomena, and if real world was random graph, then we are done. But there are, now we find that real worlds are actually power law phenomena, so are scale free networks. And the question, of course, we first wanted to talk about whether that is the case and how that could have happened. And then next we'll say basically that it so happens that, in fact, real world, power law networks also have small world phenomena. So it does. There is another explanation. But still, it is, your eyes are not cheating. It is true that, you know, there is small world phenomena in real world, and real world is power law distributed. And you can prove this. But it's important to have the right explanation, not the wrong explanation, as to why things are happening. Okay. Now, this is one model which will give you power law distribution. Another model, actually, which will give you, and in fact, showing that if you do this, you will get power law distribution, it's a nice analytical exercise. Okay? Just as showing, in fact, it's not as deep as a central limit theorem, where essentially you are saying, irrespective of the distribution each individual variable has, if you add up infinite number of them, a large number of them, you know, and track the aggregate phenomenon, it will be normal distribution. That's what central limit theorem says. That's why it's beautiful. Okay? But people are very busy trying to explain why power law phenomena occur in nature. And for web phenomena, this explanation does work, because if this is true, I can show you that the degree would be power law distribution. And you can look at this and say, yeah, that does happen on the web, because people do tend to give more links to already popular sites. Okay. The another alternative model, which also gives a sort of degree distribution to be power law distribution, is the copy model, where a new node copies a random subset of the links of an existing node. So it doesn't even bother trying to look at, should I point myself to N1 or should I point myself to N2? It just says, well, I wake up, I pick somebody in the graph, copy a whole bunch of their links, and say, if they are these people are being pointed to by this node, so I'll also point to them. Okay, this too is not surprising, at least the way web evolved. In the beginning, people used to copy over other people's home pages and then start editing them. Okay, again, these are not, so there are two parts to the proof here. One part is sociological. It's like hand waving, saying, would you not agree with me that this is likely to be possible, that this is the way people will make links. And the other part is analytical. If you give me this, then I can show you that the degree distribution is power law. Okay? Now, so these are at least close to the web reality. In fact, these two explanations are reasonably close to web reality, and these two do lead to power law networks.
What's the same effect?
What?
These two are same.
Not exactly. That's related, but they're not exactly the same, because in one case, you are picking a random node and copying its links. They're obviously related, but they're not identical. Okay? So the idea is, this one is saying, if already popular nodes, by the time you reached already popular nodes, would probably are more biased to be part of everybody's link structure. So if you take a random guy, so what this is saying is, this is a two-level explanation of junior high phenomenon. So you first go into the new classroom, you make friends with some random kid, and then take a subset of his or her friends and say, those are also my friends.
Take a random sample, uniform sample from existing link, it is actually you are choosing a number proportional to its degree.
Mm-hmm.
That is what the first thing is also.
No, I don't understand what you're saying.
You are copying a link from existing link.
No, the first one is all this is saying is, I link to a node with probability proportional to the number of links it already has. So I have a separate coin for each node. So the coin is not the same biased coin.
Okay.
It's not the same parameter P.
Okay, and the second way, we have a set of links, and out of which you choose the link at random. So, the particular node.
No, no. In the second way, you're going, you're looking at the current network, picking a random node, picking a subset of its links, and putting, you are also making those links. So you're taking a node N3, N3 is pointing to N4, N5, N6, N7, so you point to N4, N5, for example.
Yeah, there the chance of you linking to a particular node is proportional to the number of links it already has.
All I'm saying is they are connected. We can take this online offline, but these are connected, but they're not identical. Okay? They're definitely connected, but they're not identical. Okay. Let's see. So anyway, these are other places where social networks have power law phenomena, but I think this is more important for us as to why are they actually appearing in nature. Now, this is the point that was raised. So if in fact real world is power law networks, does small world phenomena occur there too? And it turns out yes. And in fact, you can analytically show that you would have small world phenomena in real networks, in power law networks. And in particular, if you consider the web degree distribution, so if you consider the link structure of the web and consider the power law distribution corresponding to that, because ultimately a power law distribution, if you remember, I showed you this. For web, the in-degree distribution is a power law, is close to a power law with R equal to 2.1, and the out-degree distribution is a power law close to 2.7. Okay? So if you, for those types of power law distributions, you can show that the average path length on a network of that type will be approximately that. Okay? Again, the important thing, if you think about what makes, when do we say that the diameter is small? The diameter is somehow logarithmic in the size of the network, then it is small. Right? If as the number of nodes in the network increase, if the diameter is only log, it's only increasing in log of the size of the network, then it's clearly small world, right? Because the worst possible scenario is you would have to go N minus 1 links to go from here to somebody else. The very best is just 1, which is complete graph. But anything close to 1, and for example, something like log rise is pretty good. So in general, the way you show you'd say the small world phenomena is to show that the diameter is actually proportional to logarithm of the network size. So again, here too, it's power law. Okay? So it looks as if this is like a huge deal for going nowhere, because we said there is small world phenomena, we said it can be explained by random networks, but random networks don't appear, and so it can, but however it turns out, you can also explain it by power law networks, which do occur in real world. Okay? What's interesting, however, is there are, while they both are small world networks, they have other differences. So in particular, scale-free networks tend to be more brittle because they tend to have certain nodes which are very high in degree. Okay? And there will be very few of them. And if you take them out, the network gets disconnected. Okay? So if an adversary is trying to bring down a network, they have a better chance if the network is a scale-free network. If on the other hand, this could be seen as a good thing or a bad thing. If you're talking about bringing down, let's say, the internet work, right, then this is a bad thing. But on the other hand, suppose you're trying to stop the spread of a disease. The fact that human social networks, the person-to-person contact networks are actually power law distribution, makes you realize that the way to do it is to stop the super spreaders. Okay, so it's not like you have to, quarantine everybody. There are going to be some people who are much more central to the network in terms of their degree. So you just, this poor typhoid Mary that you saw in the beginning of the lecture on social network, she was a super spreader. And so she got, basically, by quarantining her, and forgetting her civil rights, they did stop the typhoid, the epidemic to some extent. Okay? So, now, to take that in a little bit more detail, actually, think in terms of attacks versus disruptions on scale-free versus random networks. Okay, so first think about disruption. A disruption is a random thing. It's not like the world is against you. Some nodes will fail. Think of just a network of computers, for example, connected to each other. Some nodes will fail. Suppose a random percentage of nodes gets to fail. How much of a disruption does this cause on the underlying network if the network is a random network versus it's a powerless network? If it's uniform random network, as the percentage of failed nodes increases, the disruption keeps increasing, more or less kind of proportionally. In the powerless network, on the other hand, for most small disruptions, nothing happens to the network. The macro properties of the network are not affected at all. So this is not surprising at all, you know, because if you are randomly choosing some nodes go down, what's the chance that those random nodes would be Google and Yahoo? Very low. It's more likely that those random nodes will be one of your computer or my computer. And nobody cares. The world goes without any effect. Okay, so powerless networks are actually pretty darn good for random disruption. But that's the same thing that makes them actually quite bad for attack, deliberate attack. Had the world been, in fact, had the internet connectivity been random networks, you would not have people, you know, you would not have these denial of service attacks, for example. There has to be a real rich guy so that you can go kidnap them. If everybody has about the same money, nobody is standing out. Who are you going to kidnap? I mean, I'm not saying that you should, but you know, if you are into kidnapping, you know, if everybody has the same $3 per year, it all looks like a shallow field. Whereas suddenly there's a whole bunch of people who have some two, some three, and some $10 billion. You know, it's unclear who you're going to catch, right? So an adversarial attack, basically, an adversary would intentionally bring down systems. It's not a natural phenomenon anymore. And they're not going to say, I'm going to bring down the internet, let me go and stop Rao's computer. If so, then those are the kind of adversaries we don't have to worry about. Right? They'll probably say, I have to bring down the network, so what do I need to do? I need to bomb the cluster, you know, that's in the border of Oregon and Washington, which is where Google cluster lives. Okay, I'm not telling you to go there and do anything bad, but that's where the Google cluster lives, and so you take that out, some people would actually see a major change. Okay, similarly, backbones, you take down the backbones, you know, you would see a major change. Okay, it's an interesting thing where there are two random networks, both are random networks, one is biased random, one is uniform random. They both have certain properties common, but they also have differences. Okay, but these are the guys we'll have to live with. The scale-free networks are the guys we have to live with. Scale-free networks are good with respect to disruptions, bad with respect to attack. But that's what we have to live with. Okay. Now, one last thing about networks is this whole issue of small world phenomena, which we kept talking about a lot. The question is, if you know that the network does satisfy small world phenomenon, and in fact, now we know that most networks will satisfy small world phenomenon, most social networks will. So the question is, how would you go about exploiting it? So you know, for example, that, you know, if you think that the number of people in the world are, what, 10 billion, I guess, right now? I don't remember. Okay, so log of 10 billion is essentially what you're going to have to deal with. It's still a large number. And if you're thinking of much smaller populations, you're still talking about log of that. Yes, as the diameter. So if you ever, in trying to reach somebody, you have, you know, bothered more than log of the total number of net nodes in the network, then you know that you're not going in the right direction. Maybe there is a cheaper path. Okay, remember that all the diameter says is the shortest path between any two nodes in the network. If you do not know the shortest path, you could still have the longest path, which could be infinite, because if you keep doing cycles, you know, you keep bugging the same people, do you know, and come every other day and ask them, you know, you could spend your lifetime. So diameters are in terms of shortest path. So the question, of course, is if you, all you know about a network is that it does have small world phenomenon. The only thing you know is if you ever spent time bugging more than log n of the people, then you may as well restart and ask some other set of people. Okay? Those of you who took intro to AI last time might remember an idea called random restart. Random restart strategies, where the search basically goes depth first to certain depth, and if it hasn't yet found the solution, it just backtracks and starts randomly. I mean, not backtracks, it just goes up and starts in a totally random new direction. Here is the interesting thing. The only reason random restart strategies work is if solutions are distributed in a power law fashion. This is a theory of random restart search. Okay? So if the only time random restart search strategies will actually work for a problem is if the way the solutions are distributed in that problem follows a power law pattern. That means there are some obvious solutions that may be very long, they may take a long path to get to, but there are enough short solutions. And since there are enough short solutions, you know that if you backtrack and restart all over again, you have a chance that you'll find one of those. This is the same thing for small world phenomena. Okay, all it is going to tell you is you can do random restart search. Okay, now in general, if you have local search, local access to the network structure, the fact that the world is small world doesn't right away help you, because you don't know which of your friends are likely to know the first person who would know the person who would know the person whom you're trying to reach. Of course, you can do the mass mailing idea. So you send a mail to all your friends and saying, do any of you know the guy or anybody who might know the guy? And then they will send this mail to all their friends, and they will send their mail to all their friends, and pretty soon nobody is doing any work. This is broadcast method. It's a dumb method for searching. But if you are the only guy, and after that, you don't have to pay for the cost, broadcast method is okay. You know, so for example, something like Amber Alert or something, you know, you might do that. You know, it's like an emergency, you might do that, and people might give you some benefit of doubt. You do it the second time, they'll put you in the spam list, right? Okay, so the broadcast method doesn't work. I mean, it works, but it's obviously crazy. Okay, the other method has to be somewhat directed search. The question is, even if you're doing random restart search, which direction are you biased to take first? And there is some very interesting work in social networks and social network theory which says, in essence, that there are reasonably obvious dimensions with which you can search. And this is all psychological and sociological explanation. Okay, I'll show you that literature for that. But much more interesting point for us is we don't care, because from the point of view of web, you never really have to do local search, because you know, to the extent web is using this kind of social networks of pages connected to each other or people connected to each other, they have a central database of the entire network in front of them. If you have the central database of the network in front of you, then you are not doing execution in the real world. You're just doing a direct search on that graph to find the shortest path. There's a huge difference between doing a computer, a CPU, doing search on a graph, whether a star search or random restart search. In fact, it should do random restart search, right? Because we know it's a small world phenomenon network, so it should do random restart search. Versus you actually taking the time to send a mail or walking all the way to your individual friends' houses and saying, do you know this, do you know this? One is search, one is execution. Okay, so for the web, this thing doesn't matter. Okay, for the web it doesn't matter. It still does. These kinds of issues do matter at the network level, because you know, if you, those of you who are into networks and you know the way packets are sent, the way packets are broadcast, at that level, you know, every individual packet, it's not like there's a huge database saying where individual packets are going from where to where. There are certain aspects of the web which we do have central databases for, such as link structure. And when you have that, you don't care about decentralized search. You do the centralized search. Okay. Now, of course, there's always this issue of if there are centralized databases and if you take them over, what will happen? You know, you remember all this whole situation regarding Napster versus Orkut, versus Napster versus the people who came after Nutella, for example. Napster actually had the entire network of people, computers, and which computer had what pirated music, right? And so they could be brought down right away when recording, the first lawsuit that recording companies of America threw in, Napster had to fold up. Some of the newer ones say, we don't know. Everybody, essentially, they have, the index is distributed, right? So and they actually do decentralized search. It's clear that centralized search is much faster. It's more brittle, but it's much faster. More than being brittle, it also opens them up for lawsuits, right? Because if you have the centralized database, then I know who to catch. I know that I can just bring down Napster and the whole thing goes away, okay? Things like Nutellas and eDonkeys and all these things essentially don't have, many of these other ones don't have central databases. They, by design, try not to have central database so that they can go to the judge and say, look, we don't know. We thought all our users were legal, law-abiding citizens. They were just, you know, sharing home videos of themselves. We are just as surprised as you are that Hollywood movies and songs are being, you know. So it's an interesting reason why, you know, you could get, I mean, so it's like, it's true that link structure is central, so we don't need to worry about decentralized version. But I'm also telling you that there are other reasons why you may have to worry about decentralized search. Decentralized search is inefficient, but much more resilient to failure. You know the Fahrenheit 410? How many of you guys know Fahrenheit 410? Ray Bradbury's book. Yes. See, please somebody. Who else does? Okay, two people. Good. So you other guys should go and find out what that is. So this is a world where there's a totalitarian regime which took over the world and decided to ban all the books so that you would only read the books that the government, you know, allows you to read. And so individual people then become individual books. So you would become Anna Karenina. Somebody else will become, you know, if they're really unlucky, Canoes Volume 1. And right. And then that's it. So you would be, and so this is how they made sure that things will continue to stay. So even if they put some number of books in the jail, there is no single library that they can level down. This is like an old idea, but it does have, the reason they bring that up is because you can't kill the entire knowledge by just, you know, taking one library out. Okay? And we are talking about the same thing except for legal reasons now. We can't kill the entire file copying sharing network by just suing one single company. One way of avoiding that is to have this, you know, decentralized indexes and peer-to-peer networks. So peer-to-peer networks, the idea of local search does matter. In fact, that's one place where they do care about what's the best way to do, you know, to find a peer having a particular file, you know, without flooding the entire network with messages. Okay? But for the part of the web that we care about in this class, which is mostly link structure, there are central databases, they do exist, and so in fact, everybody who is using them, such as the MySpaces and Orkut, etc., they just use central database. And so for them, it's so easy to find, you know, the lowest, shortest connection between any pair of nodes. Okay? So there's very few decentralized search applications. This should be clarified to say for link structure of the web. But they do exist on peer-to-peer search. They do exist on all these file sharing networks, etc. Okay. In fact, by the way, the the paper that I sent you guys on the paper that I sent you guys on is Google invading my privacy, which you guys should read, and we may talk about it later. But one of the very interesting arguments in that paper is if email servers are essentially extracting phrases from your emails using quasi-NLP techniques and using that to show you advertisements that are directed towards the content of the message, which is what, you know, all of these guys are doing right now, then there would come a time when their techniques are obviously good enough that they could be held liable and responsible for not having found a conspiracy that was being hatched by a bunch of people who all have Google Mail network, you know, accounts. You know, the way it's going, everybody has a Gmail account, right? So I'm sure you should send mails to, what's his name? What's the guy? Who is our guy? We keep forgetting who is our bad guy every day. The guy is in Afghanistan. So you should send him a mail. I'm sure he's reading it, you know, in Gmail. But the argument this paper says is they will be held liable. Osama bin Laden, I forgot his name. See, I mean, we haven't been talking about him these days. We talk about Iran now, so we we forgot the old bad guy. You know, only the new bad guys. Google can actually be, Google or anybody who is doing information extraction can be held liable for not having done the right thing. You know, there's a Good Samaritan law, you know, at the end of the Seinfeld episode, for example. So if you know something and you didn't act on it, then you can be held liable. And it's not just for like some fat guy not getting into the car. It, if the world is coming to an end and you didn't tell, you know, Mr. CIA chairman, then you will be put in jail for not telling that. Okay. Not surprisingly, many institutions now are going out of their way to destroy their email every year. They don't want to have servers. It's like a weird thing. We worked very hard not to have any memory, any space restrictions on our email, and now they're removing it because they don't want to have anything to do with your email because, you know, possibly they could be held liable for what it did. And if it got destroyed, who knows what happened. Okay, which is sort of the same reason why like decentralized indexes are becoming popular on these file sharing networks. Okay, yes. Yeah, they did not destroy it fast enough. That's basically the thing. So, yeah. Okay, so this is a summary of our excursion into social networks, which won't actually end yet because we now become more focused and just consider the social networks in terms of link structure of the web, which is PageRank and authority hubs. But this is the part where we admit that people cared about this stuff even before PageRank and authority hubs came along. Just as, you know, IR was there way before web-level IR came along. Okay. So, network is considered to exhibit small world phenomena if its diameter is approximately logarithm of its size. Most uniform random networks do exhibit small world phenomena. However, most real-world networks are not uniform random, and so their degree of distribution actually shows a power law distribution. They do have small world phenomena, but they do differ in terms of their response to disruptions versus attacks. Okay. And also, in fact, I guess their response to legal liabilities in particular. And then the fact that a network exhibits small world phenomena does not necessarily mean that you can exploit it right away, unless there is a central database. All you know is there is supposed to be a short answer, right? There is supposed to be a short answer, and so you try to find it. And in fact, there is a beautiful story which is not connected to this that I'll tell you because I just feel like telling you this. George Danzig. How many of you know George Danzig? Nobody? How many of you know simplex? Simplex algorithm, linear programming. Okay, the guy who invented linear programming, the simplex algorithm for linear programming, is George Danzig. Okay, so it's now known to be an exponential time algorithm, but it just works extremely well in practice. Linear programming is polynomial. It's been shown to be polynomial time problem. But the one that actually most people still use for moderate size applications of linear programming is simplex method, which Danzig used. And there's this very interesting story about Danzig. one time when he was a grad student at Berkeley, one day he went to class late, like many of you come to the class late. And then he found a bunch of problems listed on the board. So he took them down. He assumed they are the homework problems, right? So, and then some number of days later, he went and went to the professor and said, "I'm very sorry, I seem to have gotten late behind, got behind in terms of solving this. Here are the solutions." And he went and left it. So the professor said, "Leave it there, I'll see it later." And then this guy goes home, and next day, in the middle of the night, the professor is coming and hitting on his door. Why? Because he solved a bunch of open problems. He was showing them as, these are some open problems in this area. And he wasn't told. He didn't know. He thought it was homework. And if, relative grading pressure, my God, other people are solving this, they'll get an A+, I should also get an A+. I don't know. What I'm saying is sometimes not knowing that this is an open problem helps you think that it's a short problem. It's a randomly short search sort of an idea. So knowing that there's a solution, believing that there may be a solution, because otherwise why would it be on the homework problem? This guy went and solved it, So comically, he wound up getting a bunch of journal papers, and before he started, he finished his PhD. That's a different story. So that's sort of an interesting kind of all the small world phenomena of real world tells you is, in trying to reach somebody, if you found yourself bugging more than a logarithmic number of people, then you're bugging the wrong people. Come back and bug some other set of people. That's basically randomly short search. However, if you have a central database, none of this is a problem. You can just directly use central database. Okay? And in fact, when you have a central database, whether or not there is a small world phenomenon, it doesn't matter. I can always connect you to anybody. Okay? Those are the things that we wanted to say here. Before we go out of these dark slides, I want to mention, I just want to repeat these two things. Power law distributions also work in Zipf's law in terms of the popularity of words in a language, in any natural language. I mentioned this last time. And so essentially what happens here is in Zipf distribution, the rank of a word, a rank of an entity, and the frequency of the entity, the product of the rank of an entity and its frequency, is approximately constant. So the first ranked entity times its frequency must be the same as the second ranked entity times its frequency. So the second ranked entity must be half as frequent as the first ranked entity. That's the way Zipf's law works. Okay. Again, it works quite well in practice, in the sense that that's exactly the way it seems to happen in terms of the language corpuses. It's actually hard. There's been a lot of interest in trying to explain why Zipf's law holds in real world. The fact that it does hold, anybody can see. In fact, this particular picture here, so this is for some corpus, and I pointed out last time that the most frequent word is appearing 7.3 million times. And the second most frequent word is appearing about half, 3.8 million times. It's not 7.1 million times. It's 3.8 million times, okay? 3.9 million times. The other interesting thing is this is actually a plot of the frequency of the words and their popularity in terms of Wikipedia as a corpus, the entire Wikipedia as a corpus. And once again, you see the sort of same power law distribution. And in particular, the power law, and this green line corresponds to 1 over R. So that means R being, this green law corresponds to R equal to 1. Unfortunately, I'm using the R here to mean rank. But R there was the exponent. So the green one corresponds to rank, R equal to 1 in K power minus R. Okay? And you notice again that it does fall quite close to that. It's hard to actually, there are not very compelling explanations of why this happens. In fact, one explanation that Zipf himself said was this is sort of a trade-off that developed naturally between two competing pressures. The speaker's interest in using as many different words as they want to use, and the listener's interest in keeping the number of words said to a minimum so that the amount of work that you have to do distinguishing them is easier. Okay, but these are the kinds of, this is the level of explanations that exist right now. All we know is it does occur in real world. Okay, and then we mentioned also that Heap's law is basically a corollary of Zipf's law. So if you keep increasing the size of a corpus, the vocabulary of the corpus seems to increase, obviously, sublinearly. Okay, and in particular, so its vocabulary is k times n power b, where b seems to be sort of between 0.4 and 0.6. So the vocabulary sort of increases in the square root of the size of the corpus, which is good, you know, but it's actually, it's not surprising. I mean, you probably have seen this, but this is sort of an obvious, there is an obvious explanation for Heap's law if you agree that Zipf's law holds, which is that if you think that a corpus is made by randomly selecting words and putting into documents with replacement, of course, because just because you use the word, it's not like you can never use it again. Okay, so you're making the documents by looking at your vocabulary, picking a word, putting it in, picking another word, putting it in. Now the question is, what distribution are you going to use? The dumb idea, I mean, the first idea anybody would think of is uniform distribution. That means if there are n words with 1 by n probability, you'll pick one word and then throw it in. Okay, but if Zipf's law holds, then you know that the probability should not be uniform. In fact, some words are more frequent than others. So you pick words in proportion, in probability proportional to their frequency, and then generate the corpus. Then it's guaranteed that the corpus size would be, it's guaranteed that the vocabulary size would be sublinear compared to the corpus size. Okay. So this is actually more of a material that connects to the traditional IR. And in fact, if you're doing retrieval on the language, you know, you need to know what its macro properties are. And these hold, you know, more or less. And in fact, some people also point out that the reason, I mean, there are many, remember the IDF? When you had IDF, you take a log for 1 by n. And I gave one explanation saying, think of this as information content. Another explanation, another pseudo-explanation is to see that, in fact, the frequency, the popularity in general of the words is Zipfian. And so, it, basically, since it's falling, you know, it's like falling, you know, 1,000, 500, 250, and so on, right? It's falling that way, then you are better off taking the log. That's another reason why you can explain IDF in terms of the log aspect of the IDF base. And this is more or less fun thing, but you know, unless you have any questions, there is actually, you can look it up on the web, and there is an interesting description as to why, you know, an interesting proof as to why it must be the case that if there is a universal distribution, it must be scale invariant, and because of which, if you solve a differential equation, you will get that it has to be a power law distribution corresponding to harmonic, I mean, to k power minus 1 or 1 over k. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So what I'm going to do starting today and for the next two classes is essentially doing the analysis of link structure of the web to go back and answer the question that started us on this tangential excursion into social networks. In case you're completely forgotten, that was, on, you know, while you can do IR on the web, it may still give you way too many, because of the shortness of the query and because of the largeness of the corpus, it may still give you way too many pages which are of the same similarity to the query. And you need to have another way of differentiating between them. And one obvious idea is to somehow differentiate it in terms of important versus unimportant pages. And that's what got us into how do we define importance, and we started looking at link structure of the web. Maybe many, many pages are looking up to this page by putting links to it. It's an important page. That's what got us into web, you know, social structure, social networks. So what we'll do is we'll actually talk about analyzing page importance. We'll actually start with authorities, hubs, and then page rank. Both of them are very close to each other. And then we look at, on the way to this, as part of this, we'll also see how some of that same ideas will be can be used for discovering communities on the web using the link structure. And then we'll end with trust propagation on the networks, on the link networks of the web scale networks, and then use that to somehow take the trust of the page as a consideration in deciding its importance. Okay, to get this idea, you know, there may be a very popular page, but you don't trust it. There may be a very popular person who you don't trust. Okay, so part of what happens in when you're talking about analyzing trust is it can actually, there are ideas we'll talk about, which combine the notions of page rank, authorities, hubs with the trust propagation. So they are like two orthogonal ways of talking about the importance of that page. Okay, one is more global and one is more user-centered. Okay, so that's basically the plan of action. Okay, so let's quickly go through the beginning parts of this at least. So how would you go about, you have, you know, it's clear that what you have is, you know, a web can be thought of as, let's see, yeah, any of these networks. So here, this is unfortunately bipartite, but let's look at anything else. Okay, look at these networks. Here are a bunch of pages, and I can say that if a page Q1 has a href link to page P1, there is a directed link there. That's what it is. So a web page, the web in terms of its link structure is a directed graph like this. That's all it is, okay? So the question is, if you have a network like this, what can you say in terms of the importance of a page? Now, one is interesting point is to notice that upfront, really there are two different notions of importance of a page. One is how many people are referring to you. The other is how many people that are important do you refer to? Okay? And both, as I said in, and I think in the discussions previously, and it's also true in scientific literature, you both read survey papers, because a survey paper sort of tells you all the important papers in a particular area, and refer to them too, okay? And also read original papers, because that original paper started a very specific idea. The survey paper then points to all the important guys, that's why it's important. But these notions of importance are different. Survey papers are different from original papers. I mean, you list them all together, but they are different contributions, okay? So one way of thinking about it is to differentiate these into sort of the survey importance of a node and the original contribution importance of a node. If it was papers, you would talk about this. In terms of web, you can say the authority of a node. The authority of a node in terms of how many people seem to be pointing to it, okay, and the hubness of a node in terms of how many important people is it pointing to, important nodes is it pointing to. I am using words nodes, pages, people together, but all I mean is pages really. Okay. So, oh God. So a page that is referenced by a lot of important pages is more important in terms of its authority. A page that references a lot of important pages is also important in terms of its hubness. And furthermore, it's not surprising for us to think that it's not like a one-level idea. It's not just like a one-level idea. So if it's not just the number of pages that are referring to you, it also depends on somehow how many pages are referring to that page. Okay, one way the originality of a particular paper can be enhanced is if Einstein referred to it. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if in Einstein, while he was doing his work, had to refer to Lorentz transformation, so they had to refer to Lorentz work. So suddenly Lorentz transformation becomes an important idea, even if other people didn't realize that before. Okay? So that one reference counts for way more than bunches of high school kids making reference to Lorentz transformation for their term paper. Right? So in some sense, you really realize that it depends, the importance that is conferred on you is based on the importance that the node itself has. Okay, so there's a sort of a transitive thing going on here. It's not just the immediate number of nodes that are referring to you. Okay? So obviously importance can be propagated, and we also agree that there are these two notions of importance. One is authorities and hubs. What I really want to do is for each node in the network, give two numbers, A of P and H of P. That's what I want to do. A of P would be the authority of the page. H of P is the hubness of a page. A page can be both, I mean, it will have both scores. It's not necessary that, you know, it's often the case that the pages which have very high authorities probably didn't bother writing survey papers, so they have very low, hubness. But there are also pages which are both high authority and high hubness. These are two different contributions. You know, a researcher, for example, can write both a bunch of good original papers and a bunch of survey papers. Okay? So you want to have two numbers for each node, A of P and H of P. Now, what would be a reasonable way of connecting them? I would say the following thing. I would say that if this node P has authority P, it should be somehow connected to the hub values of the nodes referring to it. Okay? And similarly, the hub value of a node P should be connected to the authorities of the pages it is referring to. So if you are a broker, your utility as a broker depends on how many good people do you know. Right, if I'm coming to you and you're going to put me in touch with some bunch of other people, then you need to know the right people. Okay? So the hubness is connected to the authority, the authorityness is connected to the hub. It's a function at least. You will agree with that. My question, of course, so now I'll just make a jump and say, why don't I just make it a linear function to make the matter simple? Okay? One of the things you will see as we are going through this whole exercise is oftentimes what is important in deciding importance of pages is whether you are consistent. Okay? If there is a scheme for assigning importance to pages, there is no real number that corresponds to the importance of any page. Okay? This is something that you have to understand. What's more important is to be consistent. This happens to me all the time when I give you partial credit. Because you haven't completed your entire solution. If you got the solution correct, you get full marks. If you did not write anything, you get zero. When you have done partial amount of work, everybody does different types of partial amounts of work, and there is no exact right number that I can give you that is well-defined partial credit for that particular partial amount of work that you did. Sometimes people stop writing in the mid-sentence. So when people come and complain to me, and you remember this, when you try to complain to me, I say that it's more important that I'm consistent. If I change it for you, I would have to change it to all other people who may have had the same notion of partialness of their trade. Okay? In the context of web, if I give you a certain amount of importance, I mean, if I say, okay, these are the notions of importance of these pages, and tomorrow Tom starts a new page and puts a couple of links to some pages, and if you change everything, so by the way, today's importance is completely different from yesterday's importance. That's no good. People lose. It's unstable, completely unstable. It's like Bush Iraq policy. At least is stable. He hasn't changed his mind. You know, that poor guy who got thrown out, who didn't get elected, was flip flopping, which we don't like. Okay, so we don't want importance measures to flip flop for small changes in the network structure. Okay? Yes?
I think there's a loop there, such as I say you are important, and you say I am important.
Yes. We'll talk about all these things. So there are, that's another interesting property. So there should also be, it should also be the case that, so the first thing we'll assume that there is a natural way things are connected to each other. So it's nobody was trying to game the system. Let's assume that first. And then we'll start talking about, can people game the rank? Okay. The another important use, I mean, so one thing that we already said before even talking about what is a good ranking, what is a ranking strategy, any specific ranking strategy, is first, it should be stable. Okay. Second, it should not be easily defeatable. Okay. These are important. I mean, these are the desiderata that we are trying to achieve. And we will see a couple of methods and see whether they actually have those properties. Okay. So anyway, so I would decide that I will define the authority as just the direct sum of hubs. And the hubness as the direct sum of authorities. Okay? This is a set of simultaneous equations. Any consistent solution to this set of simultaneous equations would be giving me the authorities and hub values for each of the pages. Okay, so the question is, how do I do this? How do I solve this? One idea would be, and these are simultaneous linear equations, by the way, right? These are linear equations. It's just a huge number of linear equations. It's 2n, where n is the number of pages. 2n linear equations, you know, but they're connected because authority is connected to hub, which is connected to authority. Now, how do I go about computing these? How do I go about solving these linear equations? Before, in fact, remember that just because you have a bunch of linear equations, it doesn't mean that it will have a unique solution. This is like 101, linear equation 101. They might sometimes have no solution, and sometimes have too many solutions. Okay? But let's first try to solve this. What would we do about solving this? The idea is essentially, first start thinking about a bunch of, you know, notation. Think of the adjacency matrix of a link graph. An adjacency matrix A basically is a graph, is a matrix of zeros and ones. Okay? And the entry PQ has one if P has a link to Q. Page P has a link to page Q, then entry PQ has value one. Now, the size of A would be what? It's an adjacency matrix. If there are n pages, size of A would be? What? N by n. Okay, it's a square matrix of n by n. Now, just because, so it is a square matrix, which is nice compared to our LSI problems where it was not even a square matrix. Okay, but remember that, but it may still not be symmetric. In particular, there is no reason for it to be symmetric, as you can see, because just because you are pointing to somebody, they don't have to point back to you. Unless, you know, this guy, you know, kind of a scheme has developed and there's like a whole conspiracy going on. So A is a square but non-symmetric matrix. Okay. Here is my idea. I will start to solve this linear equation by basically iteratively updating the authority hub values. I'll start with any authority hub values. Let's say everybody has one as the authority, one as the hub in the beginning. So in one sweep, first sweep, you update everybody's authority values based on their neighbor's hub values. Next sweep, you update everybody's hub values based on their neighbor's authority values. Next sweep, you update their authority values based on the new hub values. Next sweep, you update their hub values based on their new authority values. This is what happens in your spreadsheet. Right? When you change one thing, you know, things all change just until they come consistent again. My million-dollar idea is you do this a bunch of times and see if you get to a point where authorities and hub values don't change anymore. If they don't change, you're done. Okay? Well, what is happening when you do that? What is happening when you do this is, remember that A of I is written as A transpose of HI minus 1 because hubness is based on, you know, if you are pointing to somebody, they give contribution to your hubness. And authorities is in terms of A. So So H of I is A of the A times A of I, and A of j is A t times H of I minus 1. Okay. Now, if you write this, if you do it multiple times, what's going on is A of I, this H of I minus 1 is nothing but A of A I. Right? So what I'm saying is A of I is A transpose A times A of I minus 1. Okay? And similarly, H of I is A transpose times H of I minus 1. So when I'm doing this authority step, hub step separately, every two times I do it, I actually have essentially changed the I minus 1th authority to ith level authority by just looking at A transpose and A, nothing else. One first beautiful point is A transpose A is a symmetric square matrix, things that we love. A transpose is also a symmetric square matrix. Okay? If I keep doing this, what happens? If I keep doing this, I am essentially multiplying A of 0 by a symmetric square matrix called A transpose A power iteration. Have you done this in your homework one? What happened?
It tends to go towards
one direction. That corresponds to the principal eigenvector. So it's not a dumb idea. It looks like if you power iterate, I mean if you do this step that I told you, then you will in fact converge to the principal eigenvalue, principal eigenvector direction of this matrix for authorities, principal eigenvector direction of this matrix for hubs. All you need to do is, since the direction is the one that you converge to rather than the magnitude, you just consider the unit vector in that direction. Or alternately, after doing every one of the authorities and hub steps, you normalize the vector. So the entire authority vector is normalized such that it is always unit magnitude. So all that is changing from iteration to iteration is the mass of the vector is shifting between different directions. And if you do this power iteration, you would reach, I mean, so if you're doing this multiple times, A, you are guaranteed to stabilize under very reasonable conditions. And the direction, so if you consider the eigenvector, unit eigenvector of this matrix, that would be your authority vector, and for this matrix, that would be your hub vector. What's more interesting is that, in fact, the fastest way, now that you found this, now you would say, why would I want to do this step by step by step? I'll go to my MATLAB and give them this AAT and A matrix, so it can then take AAT and compute the eigenvalues for it. I mean, eigenvalues and vectors for it, and take the principal eigenvector. Surprise, surprise, the fastest way of computing the principal eigenvector is this. The very fastest way of computing the principal eigenvector is power iteration. So what we started as, let's see if it works, actually winds up working quite well. So we'll come back to this next time, look at more details about this authority. So you already know one idea of providing importance to pages.